This week on the World Vision Report, Vogue and glamour move over. In Afghanistan, women now have a magazine of their own. It covers everything from nail polish to news.
I think my proudest story is the one I did on teenage women prisoners who were being raped by their guards. They were going into prison as single women and coming out with babies.
And a tale of noisy livestock in West Africa.
They're not pets. They're food, work tools, and financial assets. But for me, they were a giant pain in the tuchus.
Plus, African drumming in Uruguay. Discover the rhythms of candombe. I'm Peggy Waymire, around the world with the World Vision Report. First, this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. After the Haiti earthquake, there was some talk about moving Port-au-Prince to a different location, starting the city over from scratch. Some people even suggested relocating New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. Of course, nothing came of those suggestions. But in Mexico, officials have actually done it. After a massive flood devastated a town in Chiapas, the government decided not to rebuild it. Instead, they built a completely new town in a new location. It's called Nueva Juan del Grijalva, and it came with ready-made jobs, schools, and services. It's been less than a year since villagers moved into the prefab town, and we're going to take you there in a moment. But first, reporter Grant Fuller joins us to talk about the project. Grant, welcome to the show. You know, after a disaster, communities usually rebuild right where they are. Why didn't that happen in this case?
Well, for one thing, the community of Juan del Grijalva was in a very risky zone. It was built alongside of a river. Basically, their entire community was washed away, so they had nowhere. They couldn't rebuild in the same spot because their land on which it was built had washed into the river. They called it a river tsunami, which came with along with a mudslide. And the governor flew in on a helicopter and saw the damage, and that's sort of what spurred this whole development.
So they had to resettle a whole village of people.
Yeah, and not just one village, but they also included 10 other communities from the surrounding area. There were basically less than 100 or sometimes less than 50 people in each one, but they've all come together, more than 400 families total who have sort of consolidated into this one city.
It's a very interesting idea. You just pick up all these communities and you create a new city with everything ready-made. Who came up with this idea?
Well, it started back in the late 80s and 90s with a guy named Esteban Moctezuma, who was the Secretary of Social Development in Mexico. And it was sort of a project, an idea that he had to bring together widely dispersed communities of poor people in poor states like Chiapas so that it would be easier to provide them with basic services like water and electricity. But he was never actually able to do it when he was in government. So two things happened that sort of gave the project more momentum. One was in 2000, the UN released their Millennium Development Goals. It's a wide range of initiatives and goals to sort of relieve poverty worldwide. And it includes things like increasing access to education for girls, reducing infant mortality rates, improving environmental sustainability. And so they decided to incorporate those goals into this city. And the other thing was obviously the flood. And so when the flood happened, Moctezuma went to the governor of Chiapas and proposed getting this project off the ground again. And they even went so far as to subsidize the entire thing and sort of collaborate with private foundations and provide them with everything they need at no cost.
You know, there's kind of an irony here in that this planned community with everything in it is being done in Chiapas, because Chiapas is actually the poorest state in an already very poor Mexico.
Exactly. That's what's surprising about it, is that it is in Chiapas, and it's an extremely poor state. But I think that's also the government's intent with this, is to sort of use Chiapas as an example, to say that, yes, these poor states can rise out of poverty, we can do something about this. And so they're sort of starting this project to say, hey, we can change things in Chiapas, and if we can do it there, then we can do it in other parts of Mexico too.
Help us get a feel for what a model city looks like. I mean, how do you create a model city? Take us there, if you would.
It is exactly like a model city. It's sort of like playing the game SimCity on your computer. You know, you sort of build this little subdivision where all the houses are exactly the same. It has several restaurants, a beauty parlor, a hardware store, a copy shop, the school, and the health clinic. There's another section where they have a carpentry shop, and a blacksmith, and a brick maker all next to each other.
It does sound like a game, or like Pleasantville or something.
Exactly. It's very sort of surreal walking around there.
So, Grant, you went to town, you spent a few days there and spoke with the people and filed a story for us. So let's listen to that now.
Okay, great.
Chiapas is full of water. Lakes, rivers, and waterfalls are everywhere. But for the residents of Nuevo Juan del Grijalva, this water is special. It's crystal clear. It's purified. It's not like the river water they were used to in the old village.
We used to have to run a long hose all the way down to the creek and take the water straight from there.
Ina Hernandez was a subsistence farmer before he moved here and started working at the water treatment plant. It sits on the highest point in this hilly town, so Hernandez enjoys a commanding view of a red brick sea of identical new homes below. This ultimate planned community, with rectangular backyards and smooth roads, could be mistaken for an American suburb at first. But the surrounding red dirt and bright green hillsides of rural Chiapas give it a look all its own. Up here on his water plant perch, Hernandez is clearly content with his new job.
It gives me a lot of pleasure and pride to be working here because I'm the one that lets people know it's clean water, to drink it with confidence.
Hernandez isn't the only one with a new life here. Ask anybody in this town what they used to do for a living, and you'll get the same answer every time.
Antes era campesino.
Allá pues, campesino.
Pues trabajaba en el campo.
I was a farmer, they all say. I planted corn, beans, and rice, took care of my livestock. Now, they've suddenly become bakers, butchers, and business owners. The government put Jose Arguye in charge of the local hardware store. So instead of working with farm equipment, he's selling household tools.
Era más difícil porque salía uno a las 6 de la mañana y regresaba uno a las 5.
It was harder before because I'd go out to the fields at 6 in the morning and come back at 5. And being out under the sun all day long, man, it's a tough job. But now that they gave me this hardware business, I'm here working under a roof. And after so many years working on the farm, I feel much better here now.
Just up the road from the hardware store, town brickmaker Misael Juarez watches as a worker pours a sandy mix into a tall machine. The man pulls a lever and a fresh, moist brick pops up. Later, they'll be sold to people who want to add on to their houses. Juarez has especially good reason to be grateful for a fresh start. 25 people died when the old village flooded 2 years ago.
Sí, se puede decir que sí, perdimos mucha familia. No perdimos la casa,
yes,
sino
we lost a lot of family. You could say we lost our way of life. But out there on our ranch, we didn't make any money and we couldn't get ahead. Clearly, this is a new life with a better income.
That kind of positive attitude is common in Nuevo Juan del Grijalva, even among the kids. At the new public school in the center of town, a third grade class shouts out answers during a history lesson. Outside, a class of 20 kids play a game with their phys ed teacher. When they lived in the old village, most of them had to travel by boat for hours to attend school. Some didn't go at all.
To tell you the truth, it's really nice here because now we get more education.
Carolina Diaz is 17. She was more than happy to leave behind the slow boat to school. And she loves her new life.
I'll never forget that river because some of my relatives died there. But everything is more civilized now, and one benefit is that it's easier to get things. Like if we want a kilo of rice or something, the Super Chiapas is right there, and before the market was far away from us.
The Super Chiapas Mini Mart on the main road does brisk business on this Tuesday morning. In a span of 5 minutes, eggs, pencils, chips, candy, and toothpaste fly off the shelves. Saul Juarez is the store manager here.
I'm happy because our place here is very busy. There are lots of people around. They're always passing by, and we're across from the school, so the children buy from me a lot.
Juarez makes $230 a month at the Super Chiapas, a fortune for a former campesino from the poorest state in Mexico. It's easy to get the sense that this place is perfect, but not everyone is adapting so well. Justina de Avidad misses the wide open spaces of her cattle ranch. She feels hemmed in by the identical government-built houses.
Claro, yo no me acostumbro porque pues.
I'm just not used to it yet. What happens is my mind starts to remember everything we had before, and I imagine myself living there.
It's totally different here, says Olga Suarez as she makes copies on the machine she recently learned how to use. She works in the town's office supply store. It's the first job she's ever had. For Suarez, the sudden presence of 1,000 neighbors has been a culture shock.
Well, over there we weren't used to living with so many people. We lived only with our family, so there weren't many of us around. And here, yeah, it's pretty crowded. We'll just have to get used to it.
And as for everyone making a good living around here, that's not quite happening either. At least not yet. Inside a hilltop factory, Martin Perez mixes ingredients in a big metal tub. He's making high-quality packaged cheese to be sold in Chiapas stores, thanks to a new road the government built straight from town to the mountain highway. Making shipments won't be such a problem. But like many businesses here, including a tomato greenhouse and a chicken farm, the cheese factory still isn't making the money the government hoped. So for now, Perez isn't doing much better than he did working on his farm.
Pero posteriormente voy a ganar más.
But later on, I'll make more money. If this works and moves forward, we'll profit from it. And that's all we need to be able to get by and support our kids.
Those words of his, "if this works," are the key. Can this grand experiment actually sustain itself long term?
That's Grant Fuller reporting from Nueva Juan del Grijalva in Mexico. I asked Grant if there are any plans to create more of these ready-made rural cities.
Definitely. The plan was to start with this one and see how it works and then go forward from there and build more. So I believe there are at least 5 others that are currently in the planning process, if not construction already, in Chiapas. And then I think from there the plan is to expand on to other states and use this as an example in Mexico and perhaps for other countries as well.
And it's only been in existence for less than a year. So how's it working out so far? What did you think?
Just walking around there and talking to people, most are very happy with it. What is there not to be happy about, right? They're getting everything provided for them, free housing, free education, healthcare. It's a vastly different and better life than they were living before for most of them. But that said, it remains to be seen how this is going to actually work in the long term, if it's actually going to be sustainable, like they call it, a rural sustainable city.
Thank you so much, Grant, for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Peggy.
You can see photos of the relocated town on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Coming up, imagine Vogue magazine, Afghan style. We'll hear about a successful women's magazine next on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Newspapers and magazines are having a tough time in this country. Newsweek has announced it's up for sale, and magazines like Gourmet and Cosmo Girl have shut down. But in Kabul, the magazine business is thriving, especially one that's been created by women for women. Here's Will Everett from Afghanistan.
Mohammed Masood sells magazines by a mosque. They hang like laundry on wash lines strung across his plywood kiosk. From the latest editions of Kabul's special interest weeklies to glossies from Iran and Saudi Arabia, already faded by the sun. One magazine stands out because of its bright pink border. Mohammed keeps it on a low shelf where it won't attract too much attention. He says that until last year he kept this one behind the counter, but when so many women started asking for it, he brought it out last year into plain sight. It's called Mursal, which means a kind of rose in the Dari language. It's Afghanistan's only magazine for women. Managing director and founder Najiba Ayubi strolls the walled compound where Mursal has its offices. She points to a glass enclosure running the length of one wall, where the covers of some 350 editions of the magazine, all 7 years' worth, are on display.
Here is the other magazines.
Oh, all the magazines?
Yeah.
Every issue?
every issue, from beginning up to now.
The covers show women in head coverings doing things most women in the U.S. take for granted, sitting in a classroom, voting, working at a job. But these activities were almost unheard of for women here before the fall of the Taliban. Ayubi says Mursal tries to keep women politically informed.
We have a one-page editorial. In this editorial, we try to have the hot matter in country. What is the hot topic in this time? We put in editorial.
But the magazine is also about more everyday issues.
This is not just politics. This is social. This is for women and family. We try to have health, work, problems, education, everything about women.
The most recent issue features baking tips, choosing the best nail color, as well as skincare tips. But there's also an investigative piece on the murder of a female journalist in a Taliban-controlled region. Najiba says she wants to keep Mursal edgy without stirring up so much controversy that women are afraid to buy it. Today is Mursal's weekly deadline, and the newsroom is a beehive of activity. Women in headscarves sit behind computer monitors, anxiously making last-minute changes to stories. Each week, the magazine prints 15,000 issues. Ayubi estimates that each issue is passed along up to 10 times, giving it a readership of more than 100,000. She gets emails nearly every week from women who've made life-changing decisions because of the magazine, including those who've decided to go back to school. Ayubi says the magazine's emphasis on education has inspired something else. Nasty phone calls and letters, especially from the conservative South.
They ask me, why you did this? This is not the rule of media. Why do you did this? I say, this is the rule of media. You're wrong.
As for the Taliban, Ayubi says she's had little trouble from it, though she occasionally gets anonymous threats. When the magazine first started, someone threw a rock through her living room window with a note tied onto it. It said, we will kill you.
But it is not matter for me, because I choose this way. We have to do this.
The magazine's writers include 30-year-old Milav Nasiri. She edits stories to make sure the writing is simple and straightforward, since most of the readers have only rudimentary reading skills. But her real passion is investigative journalism.
I think my proudest story is the one I did on teenage women prisoners who were being raped by their guards. They were going into prison as single women and coming out with babies.
As I try to take her picture, she pulls her head covering down to make sure her face is completely hidden from view. When I ask her what she'd like to accomplish in her career, she seems unsure.
I just want the magazine to be able to run as it has been. I can't say I really have any big dreams beyond this. I just don't want anything to change. And in Afghanistan, you never know what will happen.
For the World Vision Report, this is Will Everett, Kabul, Afghanistan.
It's not just magazines that are making it in Kabul. So is popular music. Music was banned under the Taliban, but it's making a big comeback. Here's popular Afghan singer Ali Edamadi. He's now based in Germany, and here's his latest song, Mari Basafa. خاکم بر سر فشاند و چون بادرش چشمم پر آب گشت و دلم پر آتش خاکم بر سر فشاند و چون بادرش میری به سفر ای دل بر من میری به سفر ای دل بر من میری به سفر داری تو خبر از حال دلم داری تو خبر میری و سفر ای دل بر من میری و سفر ای دل بر من میری و سفر داری تو خبر از حال دلم Anna Boyka Wyrock is a freelance reporter who's recently returned from a year in West Africa. In this reporter's notebook, she tells us about one of her biggest worries on the job.
When I showed up in West Africa, I thought I was set. I read up on the history, economy, language. I had 5 copies of my passport and 3 bottles of sunscreen. But pretty soon, I found one thing I didn't prepare for. Farm animals. In West Africa, livestock are an important part of life. They're not pets. They're food, work tools, and financial assets. But for me, they were a giant pain in the tuchus. Here's why. When I interviewed someone, usually we would sit outside on a bench in the shade. That's the most comfortable place when it's hot. But you can't control who comes to call. Like when I was speaking with a local women's group in Mali.
Et pourquoi elle ne...
Speaking French is hard enough. But it's even harder to communicate when a gaggle of guinea fowl decides to join in and ruin my recordings. I stop the interview and shoo them away.
Go away, go away, go away, go away.
Guinea fowl are noisy, funny-looking blue turkeys. But at least these particular ones graciously give us space. It's not always so easy, like those bulls in Burkina Faso. That's a country smack dab in the middle of West Africa, and one of the poorest in the world. I'm in a cotton field, and the farmer is really nice. He even demonstrates how to yoke his oxen to the plow. He puts metal rings through their noses and ties the rings together with rope. Then off they go. He starts to tell me about his farm. But just as the translator says the word cows, we hear something behind us. The farmer says, "Look out, look out!" His big gray bull is running helter-skelter across the field. Both cows are still attached at the nose. The other one trips and drags along the ground, hanging by the ring through his nostrils. Meanwhile, I cower in the corner of the field, holding my mic in a shaky hand. The farmer sends his children after the hulking oxen. But all the kids manage to do is dodge the careening feet and tails. Eventually, the cows calm down. It turns out one of the kids had been teasing the bull and spooked it. The farmer's mad and scolds his son. I get the interview back on track. The farmer tells me there's not enough rain. Fertilizer is expensive, and he makes a pittance from his crops. Sometimes, it's hard to get enough food for his large family. The thing is, his work would be impossible without the oxen. When I catch my breath, it's clear that my professional problems, roosters, guinea fowl, and even mad cows, are small in comparison.
Anna Boyko-Wyrock is a freelance reporter now based in Alabama. And that farmer you heard about in her report is just the kind of person who might apply for a microloan. Microloans have been a major tool in reducing poverty in recent years. The idea is to offer small loans, usually less than $100, to a poor person who wants to start a small business and who wouldn't qualify for a traditional bank loan. Microfinance got momentum and a lot of attention when Mohamed Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006. Yunus had created the Grameen Bank to give loans to the poor in Bangladesh. Since then, microfinance has grown by leaps and bounds. But so too has the criticism that some organizations are taking advantage of the poor by charging them enormous interest rates and making a lot of money in the process. David Rudman is a research fellow at the Center for Global Development. He says microfinance has changed over the years.
That's right. The original impulse going back to the 1970s for doing microcredit, for making these really small loans to poor people, was to help them. And the people who originally did this were not in it to make money. But one of the amazing things about microcredit, and this really makes it different from most other sort of charitable projects, is this way it can pay for itself because people are willing to pay back the loans and pay back interest. So from the very beginning, it acquired this kind of business-like character where an organization with some seed money from a donor, whether it be a government or a private benefactor, could rather rapidly scale up to serve thousands and even millions of people. And over time, the vision developed of making it into a true kind of social enterprise where people would build these microcredit institutions that would be solid enough businesses that they could go to the capital markets and take loans and issue bonds and even issue equity, shares of stock, in return for a fraction of the profits. But as I've just implied, in order to go to the capital markets, they had to be willing to share their profits, and that meant that they had to switch from being non-profit to being for-profit. And, you know, there's always been a tension about whether this microfinance was losing its soul by going for-profit, but the counter-argument was that this way, microfinance could raise lots more money and grow even faster and serve more poor people.
And it did. How many people are getting microloans?
As a rough number, we can say 100 million.
100 million people.
Right. And that's up from zero in 1975, right? So that's a huge growth.
What is the normal interest rate for a microcredit loan? Is there an average interest rate?
There are some places where it's pretty cheap to do microcredit and other places where it's more expensive. Now, there are some groups that are charging upwards of 100%. And I think that is definitely a cause for concern. It is also the exception. So we shouldn't assume that all microcreditors are like that. The best numbers we have suggest that the median interest rate, that's the 50th percentile, on a global basis, is between 20 and 30%. So most microfinance institutions are actually not charging rates much higher than credit cards. The outliers, the ones that have really high interest rates, are mostly in Latin America, where the average rate is also higher. There's one called Compartamos, which ignited a huge controversy just over 3 years ago when it went public. And its founders became multimillionaires because of the shares that they sold. And that's profit that they made, you know, on the backs of very poor Mexican women. Not just profits, but profits on 100% interest. So that really seemed to be, you know, if anything is usury, that certainly seemed to be it. They have argued that by keeping their rates so high and their profits so high, they've attracted competition and accelerated, you know, the arrival of other microfinance institutions and the growth of the whole industry, which will, they say, in the long run, bring down interest rates through competition. And that has happened to some extent.
This isn't just a matter of greed?
It's not just a matter of greed, although there certainly is some of that going on, especially when the groups that are charging like 100%. They're certainly earning higher profits than they really need to.
We have heard so much about how microcredit is helping people start businesses and then be able to send their children to school or build a roof on their house. But at these interest rates, I wonder really if people are better off with microcredit, if they're having to pay this much interest. Does it help them or is it setting them back?
There are lots of stories of people climbing out of poverty through microcredit in the way you described. And I'm sure many of those stories are true. But I do believe at this point that they are exceptional. You know, if you gave loans to three of your friends, you know, one of them might spend it on beer, another one might start a business and it would fail, another one might start a business and it would succeed. You just got to figure that microcredit has different impacts on different people. The best studies we have, and there are very few good studies, suggest that the average impact on poverty is zero, at least over the short term, 1 to 2 years that have been studied so far.
Wait a minute. The average impact on poverty is zero, meaning these microloans are not helping at all?
Well, I didn't say that. And so I think there's a difference between getting out of poverty and sort of managing poverty, managing life in poverty. I think that credit can, and savings even more, can help people manage lives where they have low and unpredictable incomes. But I don't think it's routinely helping people out of poverty.
Really? So if you give a woman, say, a $250 loan and she's able to start a sewing business or a small bakery, and these are the kinds of stories I've heard about, and then she has business and she sells to her neighbors and she has money to send her kids to school, it seems like that is helping her out of poverty. Are these just fairy tale stories and don't happen as often?
I believe those are true stories, but they're just a few stories out of 100 million people that we're talking about here. What they won't tell you on the websites for the microfinance groups is about the women who start businesses that fail, right? Or the women who don't actually start a business at all, but do something else with the money in the ways that I've talked about, like sending their kids to school, which may be a very good thing, but doesn't fit into that fairy tale about lifting yourselves out of poverty through microenterprise.
And yet you mentioned there's still 100 million people getting loans. Where is this headed?
Well, your question kind of reminds me of a personal story. I spent some time a couple years ago really digging into the academic studies where they crunch the numbers and try to see whether microcredit reduces poverty. And I looked at a study where the answer was, yes, it does. And I dug into it in detail and tried to rerun all the mathematics that were in it to see if I believed it. And I began to come to the conclusion that I did not believe it. And I wasn't deciding that, microcredit is actually bad for people. I was just concluding that you couldn't answer the question either way with the data in this study. Now, while I was doing all this number crunching, I mean, really in the weeds and doing all this stuff on my computer, I visited several microcredit operations in Egypt and also in Bangladesh. And I remember in particular in Cairo, I visited a microfinance bank branch one day, and it was loan disbursement day. I mean, lots of women were going to get new loans. And the lobby was just jammed with women, and the crowd just spilled out into the hall and down to the stairs onto the street. There must have been hundreds there with their kids, and they were waiting for hours. And they seemed very happy and excited. And I thought, you know, should I tell these women that I've just, you know, crunched some numbers on my laptop back in the hotel room, and actually we're not so sure if this is a good idea, what you're doing? And I thought that would be absurd. Who am I to tell them how to live their lives, which I know very little about? And I feel like that paradox is really important to understand. On the one hand, we don't have a lot of academic quality evidence that it's lifting people out of poverty. On the other hand, you have to kind of respect the choices of 100 million people who are voluntarily using this service. There must be something good going on there. Maybe not in every case, but in a lot of cases.
David Rudman, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
David Rudman is a research fellow at the Center for Global Development in Washington, D.C. Most of us are familiar with a different kind of credit, the kind we get when we use that little plastic card in our wallets. That's the subject of this week's Globe at a Glance. These days, it's hard to associate credit card companies with anything beneficial, but American Express is trying to buck that trend. It's offering its cardholders rewards for good work. That's right, if you have an Amex card, the company will give you 500 reward points for every hour of community service you do. You can accumulate up to 10,000 points, or 20 hours of volunteer work, each year. Then you can spend those points on something you really want, like a handbag or a gardening tool, or you can donate the points to the charity of your choice. The company has teamed up with a social action network to run the program. They help match volunteers with community service organizations in their area. If you're an Amex cardholder, all you have to do is sign up for the program, go do the volunteer work, then log your hours on a special website. And voila, you've earned yourself some brownie points. That's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. Stay with us for music and more on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. You're listening to Candombe, drum music from Uruguay. It's popular all across the country, rivaled only by Uruguayans' passion for soccer and tango. Most Uruguayans are of European descent, but this music has its roots in the African slave trade. Annie Murphy reports from Montevideo.
Wander through Montevideo's Barrio Sur neighborhood on a Sunday afternoon, and you're bound to hear the rhythms of candombe, a quick, multi-layered drum beat played by groups of people that march through the streets with big drums strapped to their shoulders. It's a tradition that dates back to the time of slavery in the 18th century. Back then, it was men who played candombe, a popular activity that slaves took up to socialize in their little free time, while also paying tribute to their African homelands. But eventually, candombe became part of Uruguay's popular culture. Now, people of all racial backgrounds play it. And in recent years, women have even begun to drum, like those in the all-female group La Melaza. Its members, all wearing elaborate handmade white, purple, and crimson outfits, play their first number of the day. They've painted each other's faces with designs from Afro-Uruguayan culture. Selvi Paez helped to form the group 5 years ago.
What happens is that women have different physical abilities, and there wasn't really a way for women to play alongside men, because they don't have the same stamina with the heavy drums. And culturally speaking, people used to look down on women playing drums, so we had to find a comfortable space where women would be able to play.
So a small group of women got together and started practicing each week in a park in Montevideo. Now, the 100-member group practices together every Sunday and makes frequent trips to distant schools and villages to share their brand of candombe. Paez says that candombe has always been used to help break barriers.
People outside the black community have always enjoyed candombe, And so it's been able to break racial barriers, because in sharing music and culture, you can find a human connection.
And this afternoon, a smaller group is headed to two rural villages to celebrate National Women's Day. Mabel Santos is in her 60s. That makes her one of the oldest members of the group, and though she plays drums, today she's dancing the part of the Mama Vieja, the elderly mother who, according to tradition, accompanies the drummers armed with a broom to help sweep away bad spirits. We're headed to these villages, she says, because in some of these places, people have never seen women play candombe, and getting to the city can be very difficult for them. So we think of this as a sort of cultural exchange. The bus rolls into the town of Sarandí de Ji, and the women tumble off the bus, shoulder their gigantic drums, and begin to play. They wind through the town in an energetic group, followed by wide-eyed kids, excited parents, curious shopkeepers, and anyone else who happens to be in the street. At the end, everyone gathers in the town plaza to dance freestyle. The group even plays Happy Birthday for two kids. Later, when it gets dark, the women take a break, standing around a fire in the main plaza. A lanky, bearded guy in his 20s approaches them shyly. His name is Horacio Lorenzo, and he wants to know if he can play a few rounds with La Malasa.
This looks interesting to me. I don't know the whole history of the group, why exactly it's only women, but it's something really original, which shows that not just men can play candombe.
The leaders of the group keep Horacio in suspense as they make a show of discussing his proposal. Finally, they tell Horacio he's welcome to join them for a few songs. He jogs home to get his drum. The women make one last loop around town, finishing with a lively piece that involves some singing about their group. Horacio, now with his big drum, has melted into the large group following La Melaza. It's pitch dark, and it's difficult to discern the race, age, or gender of the people drumming, singing, and dancing. For now, the air is just filled with the sounds of candombe. For the World Vision Report, I'm Annie Murphy in Montevideo, Uruguay.
Uruguay has a team in the 2010 World Cup. Tango and candombe will no doubt take second place to soccer for a while. More on the World Cup a little later in the show. But first, we go to Niger, a small landlocked country in West Africa. The people of Niger are hungry. That's because last year rainfall was about 70% below normal. Crops failed, and millions of people faced food shortages. But the government refused to admit there was a problem, which meant no aid and no assistance for the people who were literally starving. A new government took over Niger in February of this year, and that's led to a rather bizarre bit of good news on the famine front. George Fominian is a humanitarian affairs correspondent with Reuters AlertNet. He spoke with us from Dakar, Senegal, about the new developments. George, welcome to the World Vision Report.
Thank you.
We know that a new government took over in a coup in February in Niger, and the big news actually is that the government is now finally acknowledging that there actually is a famine in the region.
Indeed, the government of Niger, the military regime that took over, announced that they had a serious food shortage, and they set up a council to look into such issues, and which was completely a stark difference from the previous administration.
Why is it that the government before now hasn't admitted to a famine? What has kept them from doing that?
I think mainly the former government of President Tanja had issues about its image or the image of the country. And according to them, it was something which could give the impression that the government wasn't working very well and wasn't taking care of the concerns of the people.
What impact did it have that the Niger government would not talk about it or was so afraid of their image in the outside world?
I'll take you back to 2005 when they had the last food insecurity problem in Niger, and that's when the government repeatedly said they didn't have one, and it only took images from international news organizations, which were showing people who were really malnourished and so on, for the government to acknowledge that there was a problem and to finally accept that there should be international help. What this did was that it delayed the international response, and had lots more people who were affected by the situation. We're talking about 4 million people who suffered back in 2005 from these food shortages. These numbers could have been cut, maybe, if the government had admitted earlier on and given the possibility for international organizations to come in and help.
Now, the new government is admitting that there's a problem with food shortages in Niger. And what does that mean for people on the ground? What have you seen already? What difference is this making?
The first difference is this whole feeling of, you know, we are free to talk about it. People of all walks of life feel comfortable. It's like there's a first kind of relief from old men to old women in villages. All of them kept making reference of the period when they couldn't talk about their difficulties and how they believe that there are lots of people who died because they couldn't get assistance from outside because the former administration did not allow people to basically say it. There were problems with food security in the country. So there is that general feeling of relief.
Is there anything else that the government is doing, implementing on the ground, that is trying to help people who are hungry?
Most recently, they came up with a plan for free distribution of food items, about 21,000 tons of cereals to 1 million inhabitants. This is the first of its kind that is happening, and that was launched on the 15th of May. And on the ground again, they've decided to come up with a special unit which will be looking at the aid donations, the donations they're going to receive, the food aid that they're going to receive, and how to manage it and how to ensure that it gets to the population. That's what's happening now. The big thing is they're talking about food shortages in Niger, and the government is ready and willing to accept international support.
George Fominian is a humanitarian affairs correspondent with Reuters AlertNet. We spoke to him from Dakar, Senegal. You can't turn on the TV or open the newspaper these days without seeing something about South Africa. That's because the World Cup, the biggest sporting event in the world, has just begun. Hundreds of thousands of visitors have arrived in the country, and local stores and street vendors are expecting a big boost in business. One of those who's probably counting on the World Cup to bring in some extra cash is a street photographer in Pretoria. Before the game started, Torai Maduna spent a day with him and sent this report.
Church Square is a popular destination for both locals and tourists, especially on a sunny Sunday afternoon like today. You can be entertained with music. Today, the lineup includes a small theater group with children singers. And you can see the famous statue of the former president, Paul Kruger, in the center of the square. It's surrounded by a number of historic government buildings. Among them is the Palace of Justice. That's where former South African President Nelson Mandela was tried for treason and sentenced to Robben Island. And if you'd like your picture taken here, no problem. Street photographers call out to people to drum up business. More than 50 of them work here, so there's a lot of competition. So 30-year-old Siaheng Pala takes a different approach to attracting customers. Siaheng holds peanuts in his hands, and pigeons come flying to him.
When the people see you having the pigeons on your hands, they will just come and say, "How did you make this? Can you just take me a picture with those pigeons also?"
Siaheng sits under an umbrella dangling his digital camera on his neck. Next to his chair is a battery-operated printer, a device he says that's revolutionized his business. He used to take pictures using a film camera, But a few years ago, another street photographer showed up in the square fully digital. Digital camera and digital printer.
Immediately when he took one of a customer, the people did just want to see what happened in there. Many people went there, and immediately when they found out that they can take you a picture right now and get it right now, people, they were no longer interested on those photos of a long service.
By long service, Siaheng means waiting up to 4 days to get photos printed. So to compete, Siaheng had to buy the expensive equipment. Now, all the street photographers here use them.
Ready?
Christopher Yesaya is here today to get his pictures taken. Like the majority of Siaheng's customers, he's not from South Africa.
Actually, I'm going home next week, so I just want to go, you know, and show people there at home in Malawi. So I just want to show them that I was there myself.
Siaheng also gets a lot of customers from Zimbabwe, Mozambique, and Nigeria. So, besides his photography work, he often acts as a tourist guide.
They ask you about this building. Which building is this one? What was happening during the apartheid era on that building?
Siaheng has a number of loyal customers. Like Mike, who's from the South African city of Durban.
This is my favorite guy. He takes the picture good. The picture are good. Perfect.
First-time customer Lawrence Muliba is from right here in Pretoria. He's here today with his 10-year-old daughter and 4-year-old son.
Smile. Uh-huh.
Muliba looked more excited to have his picture taken than his son, who did not look into the camera. The little boy was busy blowing his little trumpet. Then Lawrence watches as his photos are printed.
I feel happy, my friend. These photos are right. I'm going to frame one of them, especially the one with the small child.
Smile. Ready? Uh-huh.
Siaheng, who's been taking pictures since college, charges $2 per photo. He says he can make about $100 on a good weekend. He's got a full-time office job during the week, but says he loves his weekend work. Only thing he doesn't like about it, the rainy season, when customers are few and far between. For the World Vision Report, I'm Taurai Maduna in Pretoria, South Africa.
Taurai sent us photos to go with this story. They're on the web at worldvisionreport.org.
Meet me in Johannesburg. Me and the whole wide world. Come by sea. Come by land. Come by air. Come hand in hand. We're celebrating.
That's Ziggy Marley, son of reggae icon Bob Marley. Ziggy shares his father's passion for soccer and for Africa. The two come together this week in South Africa with the opening of the 2010 World Cup. Ziggy Marley's released a song to celebrate. It's called Africa Land. Joining Ziggy on the track is his brother Steven and world music star Angelique Kidjo from Benin, West Africa. Marley hopes the World Cup will help people see Africa in a positive light. He says it's a new beginning for the continent.
One gold, one aim, one destiny. People, are you ready? Let's celebrate.
And that's our show for today. If you want to hear more of Ziggy Marley's song, go to our website at worldvisionreport.org. You can also read blogs from our reporters around the world or sign up to be a fan on Facebook or Twitter. The show is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is the engineering assistant. Chris Baldiga is the production assistant. Shelley Ngo is our general manager. And I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.
North Africa, West Africa, Central Africa, East Africa, South Africa. Oh, beautiful Africa land. Oh.